You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. The Republican-controlled Wisconsin Senate voted yesterday to deny the reappointment of Wisconsin Elections Commission Administrator Megan Wolf. And shortly after the vote, Democratic Attorney General Josh Call announced a suit challenging the vote, claiming that it happened illegally.
The state Senate purported to take a vote on a non-appointment of Megan Wolf. So we are here today to announce that we have filed suit in Dane County Circuit Court. We have asked the court to issue a declaratory judgment and an injunction making clear that Megan Wolf remains the administrator of the Wisconsin Election Commission.
We're going to unpack what led to yesterday's vote and later learn some more about the legal questions being asked. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this story? What do you think of this vote to try to remove Wolf as elections administrator? How important is it to you that we have an election administrator in place going into the 2024 elections? What's your response to all this? Call 800-642-1234, and that's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Anya Van Wagtendonk covers the state capitol for WPR. She covered yesterday's vote. Anya, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Can you remind us why this vote was happening in the Senate in the first place?
Yeah, so there are a lot of complicated procedural details here. Megan Wolf served out a four-year term administering Wisconsin's elections. That's including the 2020 election. And so she became sort of the face of many of the baseless accusations of fraud from supporters of former President Donald Trump. I should note that she doesn't craft election policy at all, but she was blamed for some decisions by the Elections Commission and then even for policy that predated her. So her term expired this summer, and normally the Elections Commission might renominate her to the role, but they didn't. Again, this is complicated. That was actually a sign of support because recent state law suggests that if she doesn't step down, she can just stay in the role as what's called a holdover. But Senate Republicans disagreed with that. They said she needed to go through a standard confirmation process. And so they held one, they had committee hearings and a public hearing over the last few weeks. And then yesterday's vote, which broke down along pure party lines, Republicans all voted against confirming her. Democrats voted in support.
And what was the scene like at the Capitol yesterday?
Yeah, there has been so much going on at the Capitol this week, even beyond this vote. So things were very lively. For the vote itself, press was all kind of crowded around. Democrats, who, as I mentioned, have been protesting this whole process, gave speeches on the floor calling the vote unlawful. They even tried to stop it using a procedural move again. Of course, they failed to do so. And then, you know, notably to me, as someone who does attend a lot of these types of events, you don't always see many people in the galleries of the Senate. It's kind of mundane government business most of the time. But a number of people who oppose Megan Wolf came to witness the vote. Some of these are actually kind of prominent Wisconsin election deniers who also spoke out against her at the public hearing a couple of weeks ago. And they broke into applause when the vote count was read out, which was really notable. That doesn't normally happen, and it's very much against the rules.
And you mentioned those floor speeches. I want to give a listen right now to some of what Senate Majority Leader, Republican Devin Levihue, had to say yesterday.
A key component of fair and honest elections is that the electorate have confidence in our elections. And if they don't have confidence in our elections, we're disenfranchising voters. They're not going to go out and vote if they don't feel that their vote is not going to be stolen or that there's fraud going on. The vote today represents a lack of faith the people of Wisconsin have in Megan Wolf to serve as administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission.
Senate Majority Leader Devin Levihue there. And Anya, there has been a state audit saying that some election guidance could have been clarified better. However, recounts, investigations have shown no widespread fraud and a very tidy election by all counts. However, is that narrative about confidence still sort of common among Republican leaders right now?
Yeah, and I'll just point out that the guidance that's come out, you know, criticizing some of the actions that the Elections Commission has taken, again, Wolf has no say in that. She doesn't give a vote for or against. And so some of that guidance, her job is simply to sort of communicate what the Elections Commission has already decided. But it is true that she became sort of the face of the criticisms of the 2020 election, some of which, you know, come from more official channels, some of which have been more of the kind of conspiratorial language we've heard about votes being stolen, the election being stolen from Donald Trump. So she's gotten sort of mixed up in all of that. And so that's part of what Republicans have said is that, you know, Wisconsinites deserve a clean slate. And that includes, you know, not bringing back the person who administered this very controversial election. For her part, Wolf says that giving into that argument would be a politicization of her nonpartisan office.
And Megan Wolf will be on the morning show tomorrow with Kate Archer Kent to talk more about what's going on. Has Governor Evers weighed in on this at all?
That's a good question. He has. He has weighed in support of Megan Wolf and calling yesterday's vote a sham, essentially. And that's been kind of the argument of a number of Democrats. And then also Attorney General Josh Call, you mentioned the lawsuit that he filed, essentially calling this entire process unlawful and illegal. And Evers in a statement also said that this is kind of the politicization, also the undermining of the faith in Wisconsin elections is going through this type of process is actually what undermines faith, not, you know, the actions taken by the commission or by Administrator Wolf.
And I'll correct myself. That is Monday on the morning show, not tomorrow. It's almost the weekend. Josh Call announced the lawsuit immediately after this vote, challenging the decision, as we said before. What do we know about his argument for Wolf staying on as administrator?
Yeah, so this gets back into that kind of nitty-gritty process stuff. Listeners may remember a state Supreme Court decision from last summer that allowed Fred Preen to stay on at the DNR after his term expired. And what that ruling basically found is that if an appointed official doesn't step down, there's no vacancy to fill. So in other words, the official can stay in place kind of indefinitely. Call says that precedent applies to Wolf. Democrats at the time did not support the Preen decision that was decided by a conservative court, and it was in support of a Scott Walker appointee. Democrats didn't support that, but Call says now the law is the law, and it applies to Wolf.
And, Anya, we have a presidential primary vote coming up in February of 2024, not too far off. Can you talk about the political timing of this event and what it could mean for the months ahead?
Yeah, so the first elections of next year are nonpartisan votes in February and then the presidential primary in April. That's true for us as voters, that's the timeline. But for clerks who administer the election, the 1,800 local clerks in Wisconsin, they start their jobs much, much sooner than Election Day. They order equipment and print ballots, things like that. And so we've heard from clerks that say they need to know who they answer to before then. And of course, 2024 is shaping up to be another very dramatic presidential election cycle, as they all seem to be these days. And so we really kind of need to know who's in charge going into that.
And as we wrap up, Anya, what are you watching for as a next step in this ongoing story?
Yeah, so we'll see how the DOJ lawsuit unfolds. Wolf says she's continuing in the job, sort of unless and until a court tells her not to. At the press conference yesterday, Attorney General Call said that the lawsuit may resolve relatively quickly. He said election lawsuits tend to move faster for obvious reasons. But as we just said, 2024 is right around the corner. So clock is ticking.
Anya, thanks for bringing us up to speed.
Thanks for having me.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR's state capitol reporter. We talked with her about yesterday's vote in the state Senate to remove Megan Wolf as elections administrator, a move that was challenged by Attorney General Josh Call. We're going to keep talking about the legal side of that in just a minute, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the legal side of this story? What kind of effects do you think continued challenges around this position could have on next year's elections? If you work as a clerk or part of the electoral process, we'd love to hear what you're thinking and feeling right now. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk about legal challenges around the status of Megan Wolf as Wisconsin Elections Commission Administrator. We're joined now by Eric Casper, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and Director of the school's Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we heard a little bit about it before the break, but Attorney General Call is citing a state Supreme Court decision about former Natural Resources Board Chair and member Fred Prehn as precedent for his challenge to this vote on Megan Wolf. Can you remind us again what happened with Fred Prehn and why does it matter now?
Sure. In the Prehn case, what happened is Prehn was a member of the board that directs the Department of Natural Resources. He was nominated to that position in May of 2015. He was confirmed by the Senate in November of that year for a term that was set to expire on May 1st, 2021. In April of 2021, Governor Evers nominated Sandra Nass to replace Prehn, but the Senate did not take up action on that new nomination. Prehn continued to serve on the role on the board. And by August of 2021, that resulted in the filing of a lawsuit by the Attorney General's office claiming that Prehn had was serving beyond the end of that term. And so, therefore, he shouldn't be exercising the powers of a member of that board. Fast forward to June of 2022, we get a 4-3 ruling from the Wisconsin Supreme Court that absent statutory or constitutional language prohibiting a holdover period, incumbents may lawfully hold over after their statutorily prescribed term has concluded and until their successor is appointed and qualified, meaning until a successor is nominated and confirmed by, in this case, the state Senate. And so that is one of the obviously key precedents in this case, because of that ruling stating that even though a term of office may have ended for one of these appointee positions, until a successor has gone fully through a process of being nominated and confirmed, the person in that office already can continue to serve.
So is there some uncertainty, some dispute right now about what a vacancy in public office actually means?
There is, and this in some respects goes back to the question of, first of all, what it means to be appointed, and then what, as you point out, what does it mean for there to be a vacancy? Because the statutes state that the administrator of the Elections Commission shall be appointed by a majority of the members of the commission with the advice and consent of the Senate. And so what the lawsuit here is arguing is that for a majority of the members of the commission to appoint someone, that means a majority of all of the members. And there's six members on the commission, meaning that you need four members to be voting in favor of a nominee for it to be passed on to the state Senate. The Senate majority, however, passed a resolution earlier this year stating that because the vote was 3 in favor and 3 abstaining for Administrator Wolf, that the state Senate majority considers her to have been nominated by the Elections Commission, and that's why they took up that question of confirmation here yesterday.
We're talking with Eric.
And then we get to the...
Oh, sorry, Eric. Oh, sorry, go ahead. No.
Oh, no, I was going to say, well, then that gets us to the question of if there has been an appointment or not, and therefore whether or not there's been a vacancy. Because according to the Prehn case, if you don't have some sort of definitive action that ends one's term of office or you don't have a new appointee, then the holdover can continue to serve. And so the lawsuit is arguing that there was not a formal nomination put forward here. And so therefore, the Senate rejection vote did not create a vacancy according to the terms of the Prehn case. The Senate majority, however, views this as if there was a formal nomination, then they could take action. And because they rejected that nomination, it means that the Senate action created a vacancy. And that matters in part because if there is a vacancy in terms of that administrator and it's not filled within 45 days of the vacancy occurring, then something called the Joint Committee on Legislative Organization is empowered by the statutes to appoint a temporary administrator.
We are talking with Eric Casper right now, a political science professor at UW-Eau Claire, about the latest in the story over the Wisconsin Elections Commission administrator. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We'll go to the calls now. John is with us in Appleton. Hi, John.
Greetings, and thank you for your service, both of you. I am a liberal Democrat. I was not a fan of the Prane debacle. I think that was a debacle. I think it was really bad. Now, in Megan Wolf's case, it's a little bit different for me because she's involved with elections, and elections are pretty important in our whole democratic system. So, not that the environment isn't. I'm a staunch environmentalist too. However, I think that when it comes to elections, there should be some special protection because what's happening is totally political. The Republicans don't like her because she upholds the reality that you know gets Trump booted out and considered a loser.
John, thanks for the call. I got you. You gave us a lot to work with there. Eric, John talking about how a position like Megan Wolf's should ideally be above politics. What do you think?
Well, I mean, one of the questions here, both at the circuit court level where the case has been filed and if the case does eventually get appealed up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, is does the Prane case hold as precedent, or could this case be distinguished from it? Or given that we have a different makeup on the state Supreme Court, if they hear this case, could they reverse the Prane decision? Because remember, the Prane decision was a 4-3 outcome, and Chief Justice Rogensack was in that majority. She retired, and now Justice Protasiewicz is on the court in her place. And so there's a question of whether or not the state Supreme Court will even stick to that Prane decision. But even if they do, we're dealing with a different statute with some different requirements in terms of the appointment process. We're dealing with a different type of agency, as the caller pointed out, the difference between the DNR and the Elections Commission, and kind of what the different roles of each of those agencies could be. And you're dealing with a different nominator. In this case, it's the Elections Commission that does the nomination, not the governor's office. And this situation is a little bit different in terms of there's been definitive Senate action, where in the Prane case, it was because the Senate didn't take up the nomination that the lawsuit was filed. Here we had Senate action in terms of a definitive vote yesterday. So for these or a variety of these reasons, we could wind up with the Prane case being distinguished. And there's also, as a caller pointed out, a concern here with the upcoming election and the fact that there are timely issues that need to be resolved because Election Day doesn't get pushed back farther into the future. Those election dates are already set for next year. And so you need to make sure that we have the answers that local clerks need from the administrator of the Elections Commission as those issues arise.
John, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Craig in Gays Mills. Hi, Craig.
Good afternoon. My response to this is that I feel personally insulted by this action by the Senate. I'm a chief election inspector here in Crawford County and have been for many years. And it's been said that all politics are local, but actually all elections are local. We're the ones who run the elections along with the clerks. And this saying that the public has lost confidence in the system, I think that's a result of constantly repeating groundless accusations when in fact we run very good elections. Thank you very much. And to defame the commissioner, actually, I think is personally insulting to the Democrats and the Republicans and the unaffiliated inspectors who run the actual elections.
Craig, thank you for the call. Eric, Craig saying that this goes well beyond Megan Wolf and kind of comments on the entire election system, including him.
Yeah, and I mean, there are quite a number, somewhere in the range of 1,800 or 1,900, you know, local election officials and other, you know, paid employees at the local level, and lots of volunteers who are there on the front lines running these elections. And they should be applauded for, you know, the work that they put in. And we want to make sure whatever happens with this case, I think it's important that you get timely court resolution with some definitive answer, because we don't want to be in a situation where there is confusion about who is the administrator of the Elections Commission when we're getting into a season when these elections officials and the people who work for them, and then ultimately even the volunteers, need that information that they have to rely on as far as what they're going to do on election day.
And Eric, in our last few moments here, do you think the state Supreme Court is the likely destination for this?
It seems like it might be headed there. You never know for sure. But if we're looking for a definitive answer, it may need to come from the state Supreme Court. This is, because it involves elections, it usually is the type of case that has the potential to be fast-tracked if it needs to be decided by the state Supreme Court. But again, we'll have to see how it plays out and what any type of ruling we get from a circuit court, and if that ends up being appealed or not.
We'll leave it there for now. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Casper is a professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire and director of the school's Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. We talked to them today about some of the legal aspects and challenges related to Megan Wolf's future as administrator of elections in Wisconsin. A reminder that Monday morning after 7, Megan Wolf joins The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. And coming up on Monday on Central Time, a lot of apologies sound really bad. We learn how to get better at saying we're sorry and patching things up when we make a mistake. That and more coming up Monday on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. A study published earlier this month found that 1 in 5 generic prescription drugs were cheaper when purchased through online pharmacy discount programs compared to their out-of-pocket cost with insurance. Those discounts amount to billions of dollars in potential savings for American patients. Our next guest will tell us how online pharmacy programs work, who they could benefit, and how to take advantage of them. And we want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. How high is your out-of-pocket cost for prescription meds? Are you able to afford them? What have you done to be able to pay for your medication? And have you tried shopping around with an online service like GoodRx or Amazon? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan Weissman is the creator and host of An Arm and a Leg, a podcast about why healthcare costs so much and what we can do about it. Prior to creating the podcast, he was a staff reporter for Marketplace and Chicago's WBEZ. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Dan, first off, and this may not have a simple answer, but why are generic drugs in particular so expensive in the United States?
Oh, my God. Well, it's not just generic drugs, right? It's drugs in general are super expensive in the United States. And, okay, here's why they're so expensive in general for us. And it's going to be a little complicated. But basically, when you... You know, we think of generic drugs as being super, super cheap to produce, and they are, and they don't have patents on them, so they could be sold cheaply. But often you come to the pharmacy counter and you're told, like, oh, wait, no, this, your insurance doesn't want you to take this one. It'll cost you a lot of money. What's happening there is there's our insurance contracts to a company called a pharmacy benefit manager. This is assuming you have insurance. And there's a difference between how things work with regular insurance and with pharmacy insurance. When you go to the doctor, and you get a statement from your insurance called an explanation of benefits, right? They'll tell you, like, even if you are still paying down your deductible for the year, the amount you pay before insurance kicks in, it'll say, like, hey, your doctor said that this visit would be $150, but we have a deal with them, so they only charge us $75. And so it's 75, like we're not paying this time because you're paying your deductible. It's $75 to you. So they pass that savings on to you. With pharma, not so much. So they decide what they make a deal with the drug maker, and they decide, you know, what they're going to pay, and they decide what you're going to pay, which is not necessarily connected to what they pay. So, you know, I was just looking at so that's the short of it, right? You pay what your insurance, which is to say what their pharmacy benefit manager decides you're going to pay. They also play a big role in why not just generic, but branded drugs are so expensive. Basically, they also cut deals for branded drugs, and then they, you know, they get a cut, and they, you know, they tell you what the price is that you're going to pay, but they're not telling you what they're paying. They're not necessarily passing all their savings on to you. So that's the short of it, more than the long of it, because the long one's really long.
Yeah, and in that study I mentioned, the two services that researchers were looking at were GoodRx and Amazon Pharmacy, and. Mm-hmm. I guess the big question is, when it comes to those 1 in 5 drugs that they're able to offer cheaper than insurance is, why? How are they able to do that?
Well, it's because they are, what they're doing is they're making a deal with those same pharmacy benefit managers. They're going to the same pharmacy benefit managers and saying like, hey, what's your cheapest price on this drug? Like, what do you sell it to us for? What do you help us get it for? And then they are passing those savings on to you directly. So, that's with GoodRx and Amazon, they're using those pharmacy benefit managers to get a good price. With GoodRx, they're taking a little cut from what the pharmacist at the counter would get, and then with Amazon, they are the pharmacist at the counter, so they're they're getting that. The other model that a lot of people know about is Mark Cuban's site Cost Plus Drugs, and his deal is what he says he does is, I find the cheapest generic maker of this drug, and then I sell it to you at a small markup. And so he claims he's being completely transparent about the prices. So but it's the same deal. Like you're getting the benefit of somebody else's negotiation, whereas when you get it from your insurance, it's not that way. And I was curious. I hadn't thought about this until like 10 minutes ago, but I was asking myself, well, wait a minute. Could I get a better deal than this? Because I have pretty good insurance. And so, you know, for the like medicines I take, I might pay like $10. That's like the lowest price I might pay. And I was like, but could I get that cheaper? And the answer is yes.
Yeah, and Dan, I understand that you have some personal experience of getting your drugs a lot cheaper than you might otherwise have. How did you first come to try out these online pharmacy discount programs?
Well, you know, I'm lucky, and the story's a little bit different than that. You know, I changed insurance a few years ago. And when I got the call from Walgreens saying that my prescription had renewed, like, you know, in January, they were like, and that's going to be $700. And this was like for an old generic drug that had been taking for a long time and been paying like $10 or $20 a month for. And that was when I had heard of GoodRx. And I was like, and I knew that it would allow you to kind of comparison shop to see what you would pay at different pharmacies, and that it would offer you discounts on those prices. And so I looked it up. And I was like, oh, Walgreens wants, you know, all these hundreds of dollars. And like what I would pay just the straight up no insurance price at the pharmacy counter was like several hundred dollars at Walgreens and a lot at CVS, but like $20 at Costco, which was really, really interesting. And then with the GoodRx discount, it would be less, but still a spread. That's what got me interested in this company and in kind of trying to understand how drug prices work. I was like, how can this possibly be? I ended up paying less because I was like, this can't be right. I think Walgreens just doesn't know that I have new insurance. They think I have no insurance, and that's why they're trying to charge me this crazy amount. And I went to the pharmacy. I was like, do you guys need my new insurance card? And they're like, yes. And they were like, great. Your prescription is $5. So that was my story. But it got me interested. That's how I came. I mean, I had been doing this show for a few months at that point, and I had thought I knew about drug prices was really complicated. And these entities called pharmacy benefit managers. I was like, I'm really going to have to wait until I'm a lot smarter to understand that. But once I had that experience, I was like, I need to understand this now. Like, this is too weird. So that was my learning process.
We're talking with Dan Weissman, creator and host of An Arm and a Leg, a podcast about the cost of healthcare. We're looking at online pharmacy discount programs, how they work, and who they might be a good fit for. We're taking your calls and questions, too, at 800-642-1234. Dan, you mentioned Mark Cuban's company, Cost Plus. I want to listen to a clip of him now sort of laying out the what it involves. Here he is on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
I mean, no one trusts the drug industry at all, right? And so what we said was, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. So if you go and you put in the drug and if we carry it, it'll show you not only what we sell it for, it'll show you our cost. And
like actual cost?
Actual cost, what we really pay for it. We mark it up 15%, that's it. We have a $3 pharmacy fee and $5 for shipping. That's it. And so you know exactly what we paid. And so you can trust it. And that's the first time in the pharmacy industry where when you're buying a medication, you can trust that you're paying a fair price.
So you're making money?
Not yet.
And Dan, that sounds pretty simple. Is it that simple? What are some of the costs and fees and things people should watch out for if they're considering shopping around on something like Cost Plus?
Well, it's, you know, pretty simple. Like, you know, mm-hmm. And he laid it out like, right, they're going to charge you $3 for this. They're going to charge you a shipping fee. So the question is, but here's what it has to become kind of a calculation for you each time out, right? One, you might want to compare like, will I get a better deal from Mark Cuban? Would I get a better deal through GoodRx? But the other thing is that you want to look at like, well, what if I, because when you buy your prescription through any of these services, through Amazon, Amazon's different, but through GoodRx or through Mark Cuban, essentially you're paying cash, meaning they're not involving your insurance company. So if you've got a deductible, an amount that you're supposed to pay before your insurance kicks in to cover anything, then you kind of have to look at, well, basically what's your relationship with it, right? A lot of people have deductibles in the thousands of dollars, and the amount you might pay for medication like might be, I don't know, I mean, just really, really varies, but unless you've got, I mean, but you know, some people take medications that cost thousands and thousands of dollars a year, in which case you're thinking about like, well, okay, I'm waiting for that deductible to kick in and so insurance can carry me through the rest of the year. But for a lot of people, if you're like, well, I take this thing for my high cholesterol, I take this thing for low blood pressure, whatever, you know, or I need this medication for a couple months, but it's not going to get near those thousands of dollars, I'm not worried about that, then, you know, then it might make more sense to see if you can get a better deal. I just looked it up. I was like, oh, this drug that I take that I pay $10 a month for, Mark Cuban seems to be saying he'll sell it to me for six. Like, I got to look at like the shipping and their $3 pharmacy fee. Maybe it comes up to 10 anyway. But I'm like, that's darned interesting, right? So I'm not going to come near my deductible with the medicines that I'm taking.
Sure. So it sounds like if you have that high deductible that you might not in a normal year come close to reaching, an online pharmacy program might be a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and sadly, you know, it's so terrible. There's no one thing that works for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it depends on what medicine you take and whether your insurance, which is to say their pharmacy benefit manager, has decided that that is a medicine that they will provide to you at a decent price, and what your deductible is, and what is available on the market through things like GoodRx or Amazon or Mark Cuban's Cost Plus. With Amazon, you kind of have the option of working with your insurance through them. So that's, you know, yet another. Essentially, you're kind of like mapping out scenarios everywhere you go, which is a total pain in the butt. Like why should I have to do all this homework? I mean, I can shop for, you know, a can of tuna by just like looking at the prices on the shelf. Why do I have to open up a spreadsheet and a bunch of tabs in my browser and make a couple phone calls to find out where I can get, you know, if I'm going to get ripped off on this medication I need?
We'll talk more about that homework in just a minute. Dan Weissman is our guest right now, creator and host of An Arm and a Leg, a podcast about the cost of healthcare. We're looking at online discount pharmacies and how they might be able to save you money on some drugs. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used one of these online programs like GoodRx or Amazon or Cost Plus? Have they saved you money? Or have you had bad experiences with them? And what questions do you have for Dan about how they work and why? Call 800 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Dan Weissman, creator and host of An Arm and a Leg, a podcast about why healthcare costs so much. We're talking about online pharmacy discount programs, how they work, and whether you could save money using them. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones right now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. Hello. My question has to do with a drug that has to be put into your arm in the form of a drip. I am 91 years old, and I have advanced osteoporosis. And the drug that my doctor's suggestion is called Reclast, and it will cost me about $1,000 once a year. I have to have this, plus the cost of administration. But if I could get that drug at a lesser cost and just take it to my health clinic where it could be given to me, I would very much appreciate that. So what does your guest have to say about a drug that cannot be taken by mouth?
Nancy, thanks for the call. Dan, do you know anything about that?
Dean, thanks. Nancy, I this is not something I know a whole lot about. I know a little bit, which is if you're getting a drug administered at, you know, your doctor's office or a hospital or clinic or wherever, then it kind of, my impression is it comes through them. So I wish I had a happier answer for you. Google could teach us otherwise. This isn't something I've researched, but that, you know, from folks I've talked to who have had to take kind of drugs this way, my understanding is you get it through the provider. So I'm sorry, I don't have better news for you there.
Nancy, thank you for the call. And Dan, when it comes to those really expensive drugs that really add up, another thing you've written about is these discount coupons people can get. Can you explain how those work?
How much time do we have?
Well, we have a few minutes.
It's a four-step process. Like, so the super expensive drugs, right, often sometimes are called specialty drugs, or it can cost, like, you know, thousands of dollars a month. That's like the sticker price on them. And essentially the drug makers and the insurance companies or the pharmacy benefit managers are kind of playing a game. They're kind of playing a game of chicken, and like we're caught in the middle of it. And the way it works is the drug maker sets a super, super high price. They're thinking, well, insurance is going to pay us, right? The insurance company's like, we don't want to pay that price. That's ridiculous. And they're not necessarily able to get the same kinds of discounts because they're not buying in great bulk. They don't necessarily have the, you know, they can't kind of steer you to another equivalent generic version. So they're like, okay, well, we don't want to pay this much. I know what we'll do. This is terrible. Why am I laughing? This is the worst thing ever. I mean, I'm mad about this. The insurance company's like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make you, the patient, pay out of pocket a whole bunch before we kick in. This is where we talk about deductibles, right? And not just deductibles, but also what are called co-pays, or what you get when you get with these super expensive drugs is often what they call co-insurance. Like, hey, dig me. I'm co-insuring myself. I'm like paying some percentage, maybe 20%, maybe more of the price of this medication. Like 20% of thousands of dollars is a lot, right? So the insurance company is saying, like, well, you know, sure, we are going to insure you on this drug, assuming we approve it, right? That's a whole other question. But they're like, but you're going to have to pay a whole bunch up front. And a lot of us are like, where am I going to get that kind of money? I can't pay that much. And the drug company, this is step three, if you're counting, is like, oh, here, you know what we'll do? We'll give you a coupon, and this can come in a different, in various forms. But like, we'll give you a coupon for this super expensive drug, so that'll allow you to pay your deductible, right, your share of this. Because from their perspective, like, great, they gave you $2,000. They're gonna let's say this is a drug that costs $10,000. They gave you $2,000. They're like, we're gonna get $8,000 from insurance. We would have gotten zero. So this, and we, you know, we gave Dan $2,000. Basically, we just like, you know, we're getting $8,000 instead of $10,000.
Sure,
this is a good deal for us. And so, we could get $10,000, we could get $8,000, we could get zero. We're going to take $8,000 here. So that's their move. The insurance company that has now, and the pharmacy benefit managers have now created these their own programs. They often call them copay accumulators. And basically, it's a fancy way of saying, no, Dan, you're the patient. We are counting. We're figuring out how to count it. So if you use one of those coupons, it doesn't count toward your deductible. You have to pay your own money in cash for your share, or else you're still on the hook for whatever your share is supposed to be, which is terrible. And it goes, the dance keeps going on multiple steps. So then, like, one new move is the drug company will send me a debit card. You know, they're like, oh, great, we'll send you cash. And the pharmacy benefit managers are now like, we are watching the numbers on these debit cards to make sure that they're not ones issued by the drug companies. And if we catch you using a debit card that's issued by a drug company, we will, you know, take your firstborn or, you know, screw you in some other way. So that's how terrible that is.
So with the discount coupons, the devil is in the details. We have time for another call. Let's go to Margaret, who's with us in Jackson. Hi, Margaret.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. A few years ago, I had gotten a copy of Consumers Reports, and they had a list of pharmacies and who was the most expensive and who was the cheapest. And at the top of the list, as far as being the least expensive, was healthwarehouse.com. And I'm not completely computer savvy, so I just told my doctor that's where I wanted to get my long-term prescriptions from, and he made the call to healthwarehouse.com and, you know, took care of ordering it. But I have seen as much as 90% less costs on prescriptions than from, like, Walgreens or CVS.
Wow. Margaret, thanks for sharing that. Dan, healthwarehouse.com, is that one you're familiar with?
Not till right now. I'll look them up.
There are a lot of these businesses, though. It seems like, is it a growing industry, a growing trend, these online discount programs?
I believe it's growing, and the reason it exists is because, you know, it's a pretty simple way to make a profit. You know, if you're like GoodRx is a good example, right? They, you know, they're inserting themselves in the middle of this transaction. They are finding for you the best price, but they're just, you know, they've just got a little computer system set up to do that. They're taking a percentage, like, you know, so millions of people use their service and they might get a dollar each time. Or $2 or $5 or whatever, but like they're not actually doing anything, right? They're not manufacturing any drugs. They're not themselves negotiating directly with drug makers. They're not holding inventory. They're not buying any drugs. They're not operating brick and mortar pharmacies. They're not, you know, all they're doing is putting themselves in the middle of these transactions. And which is a valuable service and one for which they do not charge us, right? They're taking a cut out of what everybody else was already taking. And that is the reason that this is possible for them to make a good business out of this, is because there's already so many people in the middle taking a cut. And they're just like, we will take a little cut from these other people's cut and find a way to get savings for you. Like, I'm not saying they're bad. I'm just saying, like, they exist. It's possible for them to do this because our system is so bad.
And Dan, we just have about 30 seconds left. If someone's listening, hearing about these programs for the first time, saying they might want to try them out, what would you have them keep in the front of their mind?
Oh, man. Shop around. You know, see where the best deal is for you. Like I said, you may have to open a spreadsheet and it stinks. And you're going to have to look at, like, what your... I was just so sorting through my email, like, where's the chart again that says what I pay for drugs on which tier of my pharmacy plan? Like, you just gotta, there's just a million things to watch like a hawk. I mean, people do it. People are, I think most people are pretty vigilant, but there's a lot to keep track of. But it's, you may well be able to find a better deal for yourself on a lot of drugs.
Well, Dan, thanks for taking the time today and for helping us break this down.
Dean, thanks for having me.
Dan Weissman is the creator and host of the podcast An Arm and a Leg. We talked to him about online pharmacy discount programs like GoodRx and Cost Plus, how they work, and who could benefit from using them. Stay tuned. There's more to come. I'm Dean Kinetter in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.